wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio. It's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Robin White, your host for this March 9 monthly Monday. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Afro Gallery, presenting the Ides of March, a pop-up on Sunday, March 15th, featuring local authors and artists, including Word, Weird War, the Zemoglyphic Museum, local artists Hello Kitska, Happy Fangs, and Hesher Park, and artist and author Stephen Leba, reading from his new memoir, We Are All Indians Now. For more information, available online at afrogallery.com. This morning on the Old Mole, Bill Resnick interviews media critic Jeff Cohen on Bernie and the Bernie campaign, the disappointment of Super Tuesday, and how, in a two-man race, he could win the Democratic Party nomination for president and beat Trump. Cohen has taught journalism, has co-founded both the media watch group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, in 1986, and later the online action group www.rootsaction.org. From the archive of August 2019, The Lost of Meaning in the Precarious Life. Clayton Morgridge elaborates on Chloe Watlington's remark that deaths of despair are really capital punishment for those who fall down in the race for success in a winners-take-all society. Clayton's conclusion is nevertheless a hopeful one. You can read his piece at the How We Are Putting Together blog.blogspot. The opening music in this piece is from Townes Van Zandt's Waiting Around to Die, one of the saddest songs ever written and emblematic of our times. Denise Morris talks with Portland Metro People's Coalition coordinating committee members Joanna Brenner and Michelle Fawcett and Anaïs Tipker of 350PDX about PMPC and why it's necessary to build power in the metro area. Partnering with Unite Oregon, Portland Metro People's Coalition is co-sponsoring a candidates forum with KBOO 90.7 FM and Common Ground. Details on the event will be announced later in the program. I am Robin White for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and thanks to KBOO members, old and new, for supporting community radio and programs like the Old Mole. Remember, you can find us on the web. Look for Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO's own website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. And now, Bill Resnick and Jeff Cohen.
Hi, Jeff Cohen. Welcome to KBOO.
It's nice to be with you.
Jeff Cohen has taught journalism, directed the Perk Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. He co-founded in 1986 the media watch group FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and still writes for them. Just seems like yesterday, but it's 34 years ago. He also co-founded the online action group, rootsaction.org. He wrote the book, Cable News Confidential, My Misadventures in Corporate Media. His website is jeffcohen.org. We're going to discuss Bernie and the Bernie campaign and how he could win both the Democratic Party nomination for president and then beat Trump. Super Tuesday was a disappointment. Jeff Cohen, what happened? How do you understand it?
Well, Biden had a lot of momentum. He had won big in South Carolina, and that got Buttigieg and Klobuchar to drop out and come to Texas and endorse him. He got some other establishment endorsements. Bloomberg spent a lot of money, but wasn't a huge factor. They thought that Bloomberg would take a lot of votes from Biden through a pure advertising campaign. So again, this was never going to be easy for Bernie. He's fighting the whole Democratic establishment. He's fighting the whole corporate media in this primary battle. The corporate media scared people about Bernie Sanders this time even more than they got a chance to do that in 2015, 2016. So It's an uphill battle for Bernie Sanders. It was always going to be an uphill battle. I'm frankly impressed. I'm here in Arizona, which is where they're going to have a primary on March 17. I'm blown away by the youth support for Bernie, the Latino support for Bernie, the union activist support for Bernie. So it's a great grassroots campaign, but it's tough to take on the Democratic Party establishment, all of the donors from Wall Street. It's hard to take on. Perhaps even more difficult is the corporate mainstream media, which is in lockstep against Bernie.
Yeah, they argue, Jeff, that Bernie is not electable. The New York Times and the Washington Post is particularly antagonistic. Bernie is not electable. And now, I don't think they're worried about electability. You wrote about that. We should talk about it. Let's talk about electability.
You're right. It's a media mantra that Bernie is a big risk. Bernie won't beat Trump. Bernie will cause a disaster in congressional and other down ballot races. The interesting thing is they say that, and right now we're down to Bernie and Biden. Biden seems incoherent in debate. He makes up stuff. He doesn't have an understanding of policy. And somehow we're supposed to believe the mainstream media that Biden would be a strong candidate, which is absurd. But I mean, the mantra is, without any evidence, Bernie won't be able to beat Trump. Biden's a stronger candidate. And then what they do is they poll the voters. And all they're doing really is sort of surveying how good their propaganda has been. How far has the propaganda reached and how far has their propaganda taken hold? Because they haven't had a serious debate. The column you refer to, Bill, is on my website at jeffcohen.org, and it was on 15 websites. It got thousands and thousands of shares. But it wasn't in the New York Times or the Washington Post. And what I pointed out was that Chris Matthews, who was a professional Bernie basher, he was on the air one day during the Nevada caucus, and he let the cat out of the bag. He actually blurted out the truth about so many of them in the Democratic establishment, what they're really worried about. He said, I wonder if Democratic moderates would really prefer 4 more years of Trump rather than a Bernie presidency, because that would have the Sanders movement taking over the Democratic Party in perpetuity. So maybe they would just feel better with 4 more years of Trump and then put in a Democrat like their own 4 years later. That's what MSNBC's Chris Matthews said on the air. And I think he was speaking for a number of Wall Street Democrats who fund both parties, a lot of the establishment that loves Biden, hates Bernie, would prefer Biden over Trump, but certainly doesn't want Bernie over Trump. And I think he was speaking that Bernie could win. And the big fear is that Bernie will win and that Bernie will transform the Democratic Party and that one day Schumer and Pelosi will be pushed aside. Because it seems like the main job of Nancy Pelosi as Speaker is to block Medicare for All, block the Green New Deal, block all sorts of progressive measures. So that's their fear, is that progressives would take over the Democratic Party. It's not that Bernie will get the nomination and then lose badly. I think the argument, I've written column after column about how Biden is a weaker candidate against Trump.
Yeah, let's talk about Bernie's program. In polling before in the last month and even during Super Tuesday, Bernie's program was overwhelmingly supported by Democrats. Even many Democrats who were frightened that Bernie was going to be a catastrophe for the party and bring in a weaponized Trump, which, of course, is much more likely if he runs against Biden, two incoherent people battling out in a debate. It's absurd, actually. It's absurd to think about the two of them.
Yeah, I think you're raising a good point. Programmatically, most Democrats support Medicare for All. They want a huge program to address climate change that also produces millions of good union jobs. They want to raise the minimum wage. They want to tax the rich. And that's not just Democrats. Most Republicans support a wealth tax. So what you're referring to are what people in the media are jokingly referring to Biden socialists. These are people who, when they're polled, support the Bernie agenda, but because they've been so propagandized that Bernie can't win and Biden's a strong candidate, they also tell pollsters, my vote was who I thought could beat Trump and wasn't who do I really believe in their programs. And the people who say I voted for who I thought could beat Trump go overwhelmingly for Biden. And I mean, I co-produced a documentary and we showed it in Portland. We showed it in 7 different cities in Oregon a few months ago. It was called The Corporate Coup d'Etat. And we interviewed longtime Democrats, white working class voters from Ohio. And they voted for Obama twice. Some of them had voted for Bernie in the Democratic primary. And then they flipped over and voted for Trump. And the reason they did that is because of NAFTA. That was the main reason, that Hillary Clinton and her husband were associated with NAFTA, which was a job killer for the industrial Midwest. And Donald Trump is going to make sure that every swing voter in Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, Pennsylvania knows that not only did Biden, you know, he was one of the minority of Democrats who voted for NAFTA, the minority of Democrats in Congress that voted for NAFTA. He was also pushing the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, to the end of the Obama administration. It's just going to be very easy for Trump to tie Biden to the swamp. Look at his son in Ukraine making all this money because of his dad. Look at how Biden protected the banks and the credit card companies against students. I mean, the only way to beat a faux populist like Trump, I believe, is with a real progressive populist program. No. Trump is serving the 1%, and here's the program that serves the 90%. That's a winning argument. Biden can't make it. And I fear that in these Rust Belt states, and I'm someone who grew up in Michigan, that they're just going to fry Biden if it's Biden versus Trump on issues like trade and Biden's corruption and connection to corporate power.
Yeah, not to mention his speech that was, unfortunately for him, recorded on audio and video, where he promises to cut Social Security and bring America back to a stable financial future.
Well, that's a key point, because
that's a disaster.
We're now at a position where Democrats can go on the offensive because Trump's new budget really threatens Medicare, Social Security, and Medicaid. But Biden is not the candidate who can pull that critique off, because, as you say, there's speech after speech where he bragged. There's the one speech where he said, I've tried to cut Social Security 4 different times in my career.
That's not
a winning argument.
No.
And seniors and older people vote more than younger people.
Yeah, $100 million worth of TV showing Biden saying that is enough to sink a Roosevelt if he had said it. We have to do a station ID, Jeff.
Okay.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. On the variety, of course, is in Struggles from Below. I'm talking to Jeff Cohn, co-founder of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and the Online Roots Action Campaign, which is part of the Struggle from Below. And the Bernie campaign can be seen as a major development of that struggle. We've discussed Super Tuesday, why Joe Biden appears to have risen from the dead, and who is more electable. It's a laugher, actually. I mean, it's a horrible, morbid laugher to think of Bernie and Trump debating. Our sense is that Bernie could well beat Trump. Let's talk a little bit more about electability. Jeff Cohn, in his victory speech after Super Tuesday, Biden called on the Democrats to unite around him, to not criticize one another, that would destroy everything. He's the front runner. We just really have to, in every way, boost him up and not give Trump material for attacking Bernie. That was, of course, aimed at Bernie and Bernie's supporters. And, of course, it also is a way that the establishment can, after Biden goes down in flames, much worse than Hillary, then they can say, that Bernie Sanders killed us.
Yeah.
But the only way Bernie can operate now is to compare their records. That's what he has to do to win Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. He has to compare their records on all these issues. What do you make of it?
Right.
How can Bernie get out of that bind, actually? I don't think it's possible, but maybe you see it as possible. He has to critique Biden.
Yeah, it's a bind that he's in, and you know it because the corporate mainstream media is still very powerful. You have all these people that see themselves as liberals or progressives. They watch MSNBC, CNN, and they get propagandized that somehow Bernie was disruptive in 2016. If people are interested in the real facts about that, The New Yorker wrote an article a couple days before Election Day where the reporter was getting very tired trailing after Bernie as he went all over the country campaigning for Hillary. And yet they have this scapegoat that Bernie somehow is the reason Hillary lost. Bernie, after the Democratic convention, did everything he was asked to try to make sure Trump didn't win. And today, you're right, they're setting up this, they're putting him in a box. Bernie is the least personal politician there is. In the debates between Bernie and Hillary, the one-on-one debates, Bernie would talk about how campaign finance and money from billionaires is an important factor, and it's not a good thing, and you shouldn't take money from them. And then Hillary said, well, are you calling me corrupt? And Bernie would retreat, because he never gets personal. And so, I mean, Bernie is going to talk about the differences between his record and Biden's record, and the mainstream media is going to say he's getting personal. The liberal media like CNN, MSNBC, he's helping Trump. Trump, the opposition researchers in the Trump campaign know every pro-corporate, anti-working class vote and comment that Biden has ever made. They don't need Bernie. They don't need columns by Jeff Cohen or Norman Solomon to tell them about Joe Biden's spotty record. The Trump campaign has known all this stuff for a year. But you are right. The mainstream media, when Bernie compares his record, Bernie was against the invasion of Iraq. Biden was for it. Bernie was a leader in the fight against NAFTA. Biden was for it. Bernie opposed Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which barred openly gay people from serving in the military, and Biden supported it. Bernie was against DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, the federal ban on same-sex marriage. Biden supported that. Bernie opposed it. The Hyde Amendment, which prevents poor women from accessing abortion, from getting any federal funds for abortion. Biden repeatedly supported that. Bernie was against it. So I'm hoping Biden, if he is the nominee, will beat Trump. I think he'd be a weaker candidate than Bernie. I'm not sure either Bernie or Biden will beat Trump, but I believe Bernie would be a stronger candidate. But predicting presidential outcomes, which is all the mainstream media do when they say Bernie can't win, Bernie can't win. And even though with our own eyes, we see Joe Biden being so weak on the campaign trail and so weak in these debates, they've convinced all these liberal Democratic voters that Bernie can't win, but Biden can win. I mean, it's a ridiculous pursuit, and it's all the mainstream media do because they won't cover policy. All they cover is horse race. Who's up, who's down, who endorsed whom. That's all they can cover in mainstream media. But if they covered policy, I think these liberal and progressive people who watch MSNBC every night or they watch CNN, if they understood the huge policy differences, as you pointed out at the beginning of this interview, Bill, his policy positions are not only more popular with Democratic voters, most of them are very popular across the political spectrum, like the Republican majority that's for raising taxes on the rich. So I believe it's foolhardy to spend all your time predicting presidential outcomes. We have an unstable reality TV star who won the last election. And 8 years before that, a young African-American with little national experience, middle name Hussein, won the presidential election. So this idea that a New York Jewish person who's supportive of democratic socialism, that he can't win an election, I just can't go there because I know it's volatile, and the role of media in a democratic society would be to help the voters understand the different policy positions instead of this barrage of Biden can win, Bernie can't win, which may or may not be true, and obviously I've argued is probably not true.
Bernie could well win. He also could well lose, and there's not much point in talking about the horse race. There is a lot of good reason, though, for doing what we did, was begin focusing on policy and actually what the American people want and how can we convince them that it's a possibility. Even if Bernie won, it seems to me, without a movement, a very powerful movement, actually, behind those programs and policies, he'll get savaged by capital strike, financial outflows. There's a whole series of things. Capital is so powerful and can move its money rapidly and bring down governments that way. They don't even have to call in the army, which they could, in fact, do, maybe. But, Jeff, tell us, it seems to me the future is in talking about climate change and the necessity of action, talking about inequality and the necessity of action, talking about housing and the precariousness of most people and how it's undermining people, talk about the opioid crisis and this epidemic of suicides in all of the states that Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden will abandon, those parts of the working class, the deplorables, as Hillary pointed out, one of the great election gaffes in this century. Yeah. What's your...
Well, look, I think there's a lot of grounds for optimism. The thing hovering over us, we all know, is the ticking time bomb of climate change. If it weren't for that, you know, if we had decades, I would be optimistic, and I'm a senior. I'd be optimistic that there are these youth movements fighting for a Green New Deal, like the Sunrise Movement. I'd be optimistic because the Democratic Socialists of America is a group now of tens of thousands of activists, and it's largely young people. And when people are polled, all young people are polled, not just, you know, those who go to liberal colleges. Young people are more favorable toward socialism, however they define it, than they are toward capitalism. Young people are the most pro-Bernie, anti-Trump demographic. They're the most anti-racist, anti-sexist. So if it wasn't for this time bomb of climate change, there'd be lots of grounds for saying, all right, my generation didn't pull it off, but this next generation or two are going to usher in a decent society and get away from the corporate greed and corporatism that's so ruined our society in the last 40 years. So there's a lot of grounds to be optimistic. 2018, think about it, with all the teacher strikes, even in conservative states, the states you were referring to, there were more workers who engaged in labor stoppages in 2018, and that's according to the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics, than in any of the previous 32 years. So there's a lot of activism. If Bernie is the president, the movement will be inspired to help him win his agenda and fight the things that you're describing, corporate media bias, capital flight. And if Biden somehow gets the nomination, and if he does, I certainly hope he beats Trump, if Biden gets the nomination, there's a huge progressive movement that's going to be ready to organize protests and petition campaigns and street demonstrations when Biden waffles. Now, if Trump gets elected, the resistance will get very, very strong, and it's going to have to go, I believe, the best tactic against Trump, and there will be some economic meltdowns in the second term, and we have this coronavirus that we haven't mentioned. But I think the best tactic against Trump, if he does get reelected, is going to be mass nonviolent demonstrations of the kind that would make Martin Luther King Jr. proud. That's the way to gum up the Trump system, and it's got to stay nonviolent. But again, we have various scenarios. In any of the scenarios post-November, progressive movements are growing, and they're especially growing among young people.
Jeff Cohn, it's been great talking to you. Thanks a lot. Keep up your good work. There's still a long way to the election, and Bernie really does have a good shot at it if he and the movement can focus on what Bernie stands for, actually, and convince people. So thanks a lot. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 97.7 FM, Portland. Later on the Old Mole, Denise Morris talks with members of the Portland Metro People's Coalition and 350 PDX about building power in the city and the upcoming candidates forum March 18th. Next, we continue our tribute to our comrade Clayton Morgridge, who passed away in February. From the archive, August 2019, The Loss of Meaning in the Precarious Life. Clayton elaborates on Chloe Waitlington's remark that deaths of despair are really capital punishment for those who fall down in the race for success in a winners-take-all society.
Sometimes I don't know where this dirty road is taking me. Sometimes I don't even know the reason why. But I guess I keep a gambling, lots of booze and lots of rambling. Well, it's easier than just a waiting around to die.
In the film Crimes and Misdemeanors, a wise European existentialist, Professor Levy, appears on video reflecting on the difficulties of living well in a universe without God. Here is one clip.
But we must always remember that when we are born, we need a great deal of love in order to persuade us to stay in life. Once we get that love, it usually lasts us. But the universe is a pretty cold place. It's we who invested with our feelings. And under certain conditions, we feel that the thing isn't worth it anymore.
What are these conditions in which we feel that life isn't worth it anymore? The conditions in which love dries up. How about a world in which there is no place for us, where we don't matter, where there is nothing we can do that has value? Is this not the world in which so many people now find themselves, the world from which they flee from their lives into a stupor brought on by alcohol and opioids, or escape from life by suicide? As Chloe Waitlington writes in a piece called Who Owns Tomorrow, life expectancy in the United States, the richest country in the world, continues to decline. Opioids, alcohol, and guns are easier to get than health care and a steady and meaningful job. With no hope for the future, Americans are dying en masse by drug overdose, liver failure, and suicide. 70,000 more Americans died in 2017 than in 2016. 47,000 of those additional deaths were self-inflicted, 120 souls per day. Over 1.5 million others tried, but did not succeed. Waitlington was moved to write this piece by the fate of her brother, Rodney. Rodney ran up a large student loan debt going to college, but was unable to finish, which meant he couldn't get a well-paying job. Hounded by collection agents, he worked various jobs for a few months until the creditors caught up with him and started garnishing his wages. Then he would get by for a while selling food at music festivals. His sister writes, "Thousands of people knew and loved him from the jam band circuit. He was an anarchist, but ethically rather than politically. I found these lines in one of his notebooks after he passed away. Every time you loan a tool to a neighbor, share food with the hungry, or give a ride to a stranger, you are embracing the anarchist ideal. Live it." But he couldn't live it always. The crisis of never finishing college became a source of lifelong shame for Rodney as debt collectors hounded him for money he didn't have. The way they hunted him across the country meant that he was never sitting still for more than 6 months his entire adult life. My brother took his life in April of last year. Rodney left no note, just several empty bottles of vodka. Until a few hours before he died, he had been 2 months sober, trying a keto diet and going for 13-mile runs while working full-time. He was struggling to better himself until the last moment, but came up against more powerful forces. It is not a unique story. Shortly after Rodney's death, a student loan company called my mom to ask about payment of the debt. "He's dead," she replied. The agent offered her condolences but explained that death did not alter the terms of their contract. End of quote. Unemployment, underemployment, uncertain employment, meaningless employment, and debt. These are among the soul killers that are abroad in our land today. Chloe Watlington writes, "Yes, these deaths are deaths of despair, but more precisely, they are capital punishment for those who fall down in a winner-take-all society." Further undermining the conditions in which it is worth staying alive is what Watlington calls the evaporation of public life, the decline in social experiences not organized around pay or profit. Recall Desiree Helliger's piece about the city of Portland closing the Columbia Pool and other rec center activities, as well as cutting daycare at multiple sites that serve low-income people. The threat of eviction and homelessness hangs over the heads of millions, and we can see the results of that every day on the streets of Portland and every other city. Watlington concludes her piece, "People are tired of it all, but find that they have no one to turn to. They are too suspicious of each other, too cynical about the motives lurking behind every attempt at fellow feeling and human connection. To get to the future we need, we are going to have to generate new collective lives out of the wreckage of neoliberal atomization." Well, I think Watlington is somewhat too pessimistic here. Political and social forces are rising up that challenge the rule of obscene wealth and corporate power. Many people are making friends with socialism as a concept and as a movement. Organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, the Bernie Sanders campaign, Black Lives Matter, tenants' unions, teachers' unions, and many others are venues where people can generate new collective lives out of the wreckage of neoliberal atomization and reestablish fellow feeling and human connection. And beyond finding meaning in their own lives, they are working to bring about that better world that we know in our hearts is possible, a world organized and directed by the goal of a flourishing life, a desirable life on this fragile planet, rather than the meaningless and unsustainable goal of enriching the already rich.
Armstrong and his band, a song called My Sweet. To me, it evokes the sunnier world in which life on Earth finally finds its groove and we can see our way beyond the gloomy clouds that now lie before us.
I'm Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. We close today's show with Denise Morris talking with Portland Metro People's Coalition members Johanna Brenner and Michelle Fawcett and Anais Tipker of 350 PDX about the PMPC and why it is necessary to build power in the metro area.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole, and I'm here with Johanna Brenner and Michelle Fawcett, both coordinating committee members for the Portland Metro People's Coalition. Also, we're joined by Anais Tipker, who is with 350 PDX, a participating member organization. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
This morning, we want to talk about the Portland Metro People's Coalition, which is a very exciting organization. And you've all been busy organizing and gearing up for a candidates forum, so we'll get to that. But I want to first start with talking about the organization itself. From the website, which is portlandpeoplescoalition.org, folks can check them out there. You mentioned that there's organizing to take power in cities all over the place, and that these are municipalist movements, and one is and has been taking shape here in Portland. So why don't we start with that, talking about what the organization is and some of the things that you've been able to accomplish over the last year or so.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having us on this morning. The Portland Metro People's Coalition is a coalition of 20 grassroots organizations here in the Portland metro area. And we are trying to sort of create a new organizing model whereby we build power by organizing together across our single issues beyond electoral cycles to build coordinated, unified, and strategic power. And by that I mean, let's get together, combine our resources, find areas of intersection in our work, and see if there's ways in which we can support each other to create a more just and egalitarian Portland Metro region. So the Portland Metro People's Coalition, which is otherwise known as the PMPC, got started after the November 2016 elections. We were concerned with how are we as grassroots organizations going to deal with the threats coming down on us from the federal level when we are already struggling to achieve our social justice goals. And so we wanted to see if we can find a new way to organize together to increase our capacity and build our power. So we first started by studying other municipalist movements around the world in Barcelona, Spain, with the Barcelona en Comú organization, the Malcolm X grassroots movement in Jackson, Mississippi, and closer to home at the Richmond Progressive Alliance in California. So these groups, what they had in common was really strong, broad-based community organizing work in combination with trying to get into the halls of power itself and electing candidates, working with candidates on the inside to actually affect the change that we want to see. So in the Richmond Progressive Alliance case, they eventually won a majority on city council and were able to win $15 minimum wage, really strong advances in police accountability and reform and immigrant rights and other areas that we too share here in Portland. So we wanted to see if we could kind of follow along in that model. The way in which we did that was in the spring of 2017, we met with dozens of organizers around the Portland metro area to brainstorm a shared bill of rights. And this is based on the model that the RPA, Richmond Progressive Alliance group, started with, because we had to see if we had shared principles to begin with. And so we brainstormed the highest visionary principles in housing justice, environmental justice, in houseless rights, in police accountability. We talked about all of these issues that concern us, and we built a bill of rights that we agreed that we would all aspire to, that it best encapsulates the goals that we are working toward individually at the time, but that we can perhaps start to work together toward. We then went on a listening tour in the fall of 2017 to 40 different social justice organizations. And we asked if they supported the Bill of Rights and if they were working on any campaigns that aspired to achieve the principles of the Bill of Rights. And we found that there were a number of groups that were working on policy campaigns, very material, concrete gains for people that would help realize this Bill of Rights, this visionary idea of a city that is just and egalitarian for all. And then we had a People's Convention in the spring of 2018. And 20 organizations participated. They voted unanimously to support the Bill of Rights and the policy platform, which again are the planks of actual concrete policies that we're working to achieve. And since that time, we've been meeting bi-monthly. We had representatives from 20 of these organizations. We get together, we talk about our work, we talk about how we can coordinate our efforts going forward, how do we find intersections in our work, how do we avoid duplication and avoid conflict? How do we coordinate to achieve our goals, which are definitely challenging policy goals, but we do believe that by working together, we can achieve them.
Yeah, if I could just add what Michelle said about the Portland Metro People's Coalition Bill of Rights and platform. Well, very often, our goals for change are limited because it's important to win something, but it's not clear that we can win very much. So what we're trying to do is to have these larger aspirations. For example, All Portland Metro residents have the right to live in communities free from the fear of physical and mental harm. So that means that we have a very different view of what public safety means, right? So that's a principle. The question is, what kind of thing can we put into place that is going to enact that principle? And very often, it's clear that the only way to get some kind of significant change is to have a really strong movement pushing for it. So that's our idea. You have goals for our platform that are not easily won, but they're potentially can be won if we all are able to organize for them.
And Johanna, on the website, there's a number of different articles and readings and case studies that folks can go to look at the successes and some of the details of how that organizing happened. And you have an article on there as well, Johanna, which is Building Power in the City. And you talk a little bit about the process of engaging with electoral politics. It seems like you're making a case for engaging in electoral politics in a particular way that is often really a challenge for the left to kind of overcome and get behind.
Right. That's true. Personally, I spent most of my activist life wanting to have nothing to do with electoral politics and only doing grassroots organizing, because generally electoral politics is pretty disappointing. But the Richmond Progressive Alliance example and the example from what Cooperation Jackson was able to do in electing a mayor gave me a different perspective. I think, though, what's really important about what we're trying to do is we are not an electoral body. You know, we're not an electoral coalition. We are an ongoing grassroots organizing coalition who are working to also be able to have representation inside city government that can really help us. I think Anna East could talk a little bit about that inside outside, how you do that.
Yeah, I want to jump in. Thanks, Johanna, just because as you're talking, I'm thinking about some of the ways in which being part of PMPC, it was very attractive to our organization, 350PDX, for a lot of different reasons. One is because of the focus on the city level. And I think part of that, like you were talking, Michelle, the history of the time that this came about, you know, it arose at a time when we were feeling within the climate and environmental movement that we had absolutely zero potential for positive change on a national level. Things were and are still looking very grim. And so finding effective ways to work specifically at the city level was very exciting. And I think just having that space to come together as groups with a clear focus on a shared vision, like you said, is really important. But also coming back to this issue of electoral politics, I agree with everything you're saying. I'm also thinking, though, more about policy and the development of policy that's been happening, which obviously ties into electoral politics. But what I think is often really great for our participation is the issues that we're talking about at PMPC are things like affordable, accessible housing, are things like protecting the basic kind of civic rights and protections of everyone in the city, whether that's through policing or protecting the rights of immigrants. Those are issues that tie into climate and environmental justice issues. And I think within our movements, we're understanding that better and better all the time. That's the way that we're talking. But figuring out how to bring those threads together in policy takes a lot of different perspectives and takes the expertise of organizations that are really focused on those issues. So for us, it's just a very fertile space to talk about how policy gets developed, to dream big, but also to work kind of realistically. And then to go back and do some education and motivation with our own supporters who maybe haven't been thinking about those issues. It's really a great space for that. We certainly, within our own organizing, have focused on working with City Hall or trying to. I think we're in a city that has expressed a lot of good intentions around climate and environment and getting people and policies that will actually move us forward in real ways on those issues is critically important. So that's what PMPC helps do, and that's what things like the upcoming candidate forum are designed to help us really get those issues front and center and get people thinking about what do they expect of their elected officials.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM radio. I'm Denise Morris, here this morning with Johanna Brenner, Michelle Fawcett, and Anais Tupker. We are talking about the Portland Metro People's Coalition, a really interesting and exciting organization. The website is portlandpeoplescoalition.org. Folks can find all kinds of information and important articles and case studies. So let's move into this next piece here. We have an upcoming electoral forum. It's a candidates forum that will be on Wednesday, March 18th. That's coming right up, 6 to 8:30 p.m. It'll be at the Metropolitan Community Church, and that is in Southeast Portland. We'll give that information in full at the end of the program.
So let me first say about what the purpose of a candidates forum is. This is not to decide who we are going to endorse. It's to decide which candidates endorse us and our vision 2020. And actually our slogan is, do you have 2020 vision? We are focusing on Portland City Commissioner position 2. But before we get to that, I just want to say two things. First, we're partnering with Unite Oregon, which is a terrific organization that's been around longer than we have and very deeply embedded in the refugee and immigrant communities and poor people's communities here in the city. And our goal is to raise up these issues, as Anais said. What is their approach to the questions that we care about?
We are asking candidates to endorse our platform, and our platform consists of 9 different active campaigns that the 20 participating members of the PMPC are currently working on. Each campaign is led by different groups within the PMPC, but all of us support them and lend assistance where we can. So those platform items include the Right to Rest Ordinance, which is led by Right to Survive and Sisters of the Road. They are looking to end the criminalization of the houseless, end the wasteful and very brutal procedure of sweeps. Another policy is the For a Fair Police Contract That Serves the Public. This is being led by the Portland Police Reform Network, which is a coalition of organizations that includes the PMPC and Unite Oregon. And they are working together to try to make the PPA contract, which is up this year, be a more transparent and accountable police contract. Our housing policy is the Rental Services Office. We are working on a tenant protection ordinance, which is a policy campaign that is led by Portland Tenants United, looking to beef up the current Rental Services Office so it provides more information and protection for tenants against landlord harassment. We also have the Oregon DA, District Attorney for the People campaign. We're working with Surge and with the Oregon DA for the People campaign to support and lift up that campaign for a more progressive district attorney in our county. Another policy we're working on is the Up Now Universal Preschool in Multnomah County, which is being led by the Up Now Coalition and Portland DSA for free universal preschool for children ages 3 and 4 throughout the Multnomah County area.
A couple more really important issues that we're working on for 2020. Campaign finance reform already passed at the local level, but we need to get a state initiative passed this upcoming election so that it can be implemented. So that's a gain that we've already had. Municipal bank and municipal broadband are very central to our vision of expanding the commons. That is, expanding the things that we hold in common and that we have as part of our public services instead of things that are controlled by private entities. So the municipal bank is a project that we're working on. It'll be a while before that can be implemented. It's a pretty exciting project, and it could make a huge difference ultimately in what our city can do. And municipal broadband is on its way. It's under review by a consulting company that's going to report back to local governments about how to implement municipal broadband that would make sure that every citizen, every resident of our metro area has access in their home to the internet, which is so important. And then we are working with the Portland Harbor Community Coalition. They are an organization, a coalition of many different groups, especially frontline communities, people of color organizations, grassroots organizations who depend on and live near the Willamette River. They are very concerned about what's going to happen with the Willamette Superfund cleanup site, and they are pushing very, very hard to have community involvement in decision making about that, what's going to happen with that site. And they're also very focused on pushing for what's called community benefit agreements, including the work that's done has opportunities for local people for jobs, and that the decisions that are made about what to use that area for are informed by the needs of the people who live, work, and play near the river. Universal Pre-K is another really exciting point on our 2020 platform. It's a campaign to get universal preschool for 4 and 5 year olds with living wages for childcare workers and very diverse places where people can access childcare, culturally competent childcare, culturally sensitive, based in their communities. So it's a really great program for universal preschool. But the beauty of it is, and from my point of view, is that it is going to be funded through a tax on wealthy households. And we're all aware of how many needs we have in our Portland metro area and how much wealth inequality there is. And this is an opportunity through expanding our quality public services to redistribute wealth from the top to the rest of us. And that's a very important principle for Portland Metro People's Coalition.
I want to throw in that, you know, as I'm listening to you talk about the platform, it just reminds me of why this is so relevant to our shared work. And especially, again, I can only speak, this is a diverse coalition, there are different groups, so I can really kind of only speak to the environmental climate piece. But I think we so often get caught up in all the things that we have to fix right now, this, you know, the crisis of our climate. And we don't talk enough about how you cannot be successful at that work if people are not having their really basic needs met. And I don't mean just their material needs. I mean their needs for a basic level of security in their lives, for space to deal with trauma, for whatever it might be. But there's a certain level of safety and security that people have to have before we can deal with these other issues. And I think we don't talk enough about that, like we being, again, sort of the environmental climate movement or some spaces of it. And PMPC's vision is so much about really saying, what do people actually need? Let's talk about that. Let's shift our city around to deal with that first. It's just very invigorating, and I think it's a different way of talking about what we need to do.
I agree.
And I just wanted to say one more thing about why we might think about this election cycle and what it could mean. Again, movements are what counts. Movements is where we build power, at the grassroots, through our organizing. But when you have an ally in government who's there that you can draw on, this can really take your work further. It just makes it easier. So in this upcoming election, and I think one example I can speak to with my own experience in the police reform work is that Commissioner Hardesty, she ran on the issue of police accountability, and she has been true to her word. She has done what she can to forward that issue in the city council. she's a lone voice. She can't do it by herself. She needs the community behind her. But it's made our work easier to have someone there who has supported this issue. And I think to a certain extent, Commissioner Udaly has done the same thing with the renters issue. She has been an advocate, and we have an opportunity with this election to have more advocates inside city government, and we should take advantage of this opportunity. So this comes back to why we're doing the Candidates Forum. The Candidates Forum, we have a lot of interesting people running, and I think it's important for everyone, if they can, to get educated about what people stand for and which one of these candidates do we feel, do you think, is going to be most reliable and accountable for pushing our vision further. So that's why we decided, as a something that we did together as a coalition and partnering with Unite Oregon, that's why we decided to do a candidates forum.
And again, folks can find information on the website, which is portlandpeoplescoalition.org. Also, the candidates forum will be Wednesday, March 18th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Community Church. That's 2828 Southeast Stevens Street. ASL services provided, and it is co-sponsored also by KBOO, which you are listening to, KBOO 90.7 FM, and it's community radio. I want to thank you all three for joining me this morning, Johanna Brenner, Michelle Fawcett, and Anais Tipker, all involved with Portland Metro People's Coalition in one way or another. It's a really exciting organization, and I highly encourage people to get on the website and check it out, portlandpeoplescoalition.org. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nazi movement, so many miles to be done. Well, we're gonna take this movement onto the streets. One day, to get the handwrite this shit. People power in the disco hour. People power in the disco hour. People power in the disco hour. There's gonna be people power in that disco hour.
This is Robin White on KBOO, Portland, Oregon. It is a collective labor that brings you to the Old Mole every Monday at 9 a.m. Thanks to our Old Mole contributors and guests, Bill Resnick, Jeff Cohen, Denise Morris, Johanna Brenner, Michelle Fawcett, and Anais Tipker. Partnering with Unite Oregon, Portland Metro People's Coalition is co-sponsoring a candidates forum with the KBOO 97.FM and Common Ground. Find out who shares your vision on March 18th, 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Community Church, 2828 Southeast Stevens Street, Portland, Oregon, 97214. ALS services provided. Thanks for tuning in to the Old Mole. This is Robin White.